This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's imperative that the elected officials that are in place continue to connect the dots. And we can't just tell people, oh, get out of your cars. We have to make it practical for them.
How many of us have ever watched the boundless energy of little kids playing and thought, if only you could capture that energy, you could light up a whole city? Well, my first guest today on Sea Change Radio, Chris Cannon, is doing just that. His nonprofit, Empowered Playgrounds, taps the kinetic movement of children at play and converts it into usable power in electricity-deprived locales in the West African nation of Ghana. In the second half of the show, we move from the global to the local. Working in California's third largest city and the 10th largest city in the U.S., City Council member Ash Kalra expends a large portion of his energy ensuring clean air, water, and transportation are available in San Jose and the surrounding area for generations to come. I'm joined now by Chris Cannon. He's the executive director of Empower Playgrounds. Chris, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. This is a good opportunity. Happy to speak with you.
So tell us about your technology. A lot of us have thought about sometimes if we could just harness the kinetic energy of our kids into something useful, this would be great. And you've actually put this into action.
Definitely. So we're actually a nonprofit operating in Ghana. And what we have is a merry-go-round that generates electricity that's used to charge portable LED lanterns. So essentially, kids come to school, they play on this merry-go-round during recess and during breaks, and then it provides lighting for them to do homework, to read, to study together once they get home in the evenings after the sun has gone down.
What is the breakdown between solar and kinetic energy in your technology, Chris?
As part of the system, there's a small solar panel that mainly supplies power for the electronics in the charging station. So there's a controller and an inverter as a way to, change the power so that it's usable and stored in the battery, and also a way for us to track how much is generated and how much is used to charge the lanterns. The solar panel essentially provides enough to keep everything running on long breaks, on weekends, on holidays, so that the battery doesn't get discharged too much, because that really cuts down on the lifespan, which would increase our maintenance cost. So almost all of the power that's used to charge these LED lanterns comes from the merry-go-round. And it's essentially a windmill with a merry-go-round placed on top. So inside there's kind of an output maximizing gearbox, which helps it remain fun for the children to play on. We really didn't want this thing to be like a work wheel where it was a one-to-one ratio. So the gearbox allows it to free spin a little bit while increasing, kind of stepping up the RPMs that then go to a windmill generator that has rare earth magnets in it and coils. And that's what actually creates the energy, which is then transferred through underground cables that we bury that go to the charging station inside the schoolhouse.
So what's the focus of the program once you've harnessed this kinetic energy from playgrounds, Chris? Do you light up playgrounds as well as give lanterns to kids to bring home?
Our focus is actually on providing educational opportunities, more access to learning for students who live in these really remote, deprived areas. So all the communities we work in are without access to the power grid. So this merry-go-round actually charges portable lanterns made by Energizer, that students charge at school and then take home and do homework and read for up to 2 weeks. And then they bring them back and charge them again.
How many lanterns are being powered on a nightly basis by these kids playing on an average-sized playground?
Well, we have 40 schools across Ghana with about 8,000 students. And there are probably, there are 40 lanterns at each school. So it's a pretty expansive program for how small of an organization we are. We maintain all of this with one full-time and one part-time staff in the U.S. and then two full-time in Ghana.
Have you gotten any feedback from teachers in the school that are saying that now that the kids know that their playing is going to light up their houses, are the playgrounds getting more actively used?
Definitely. In almost every single community we work in, this is the only kind of formal playground equipment. Children are playing with, rudimentary cars they make out of tin cans. They're playing with car tires, rocks. They play together because they don't have other toys to play with. So what we see is that initially the attendance at school goes up because children are excited to have something that's different. You know, in a village where everything is kind of earth-toned, these primary colored merry-go-rounds really stand out. They look very foreign amidst the landscape.
Can you walk us through what the economics are for one playground?
So the entire cost for one of our systems is $10,000. So that includes the electricity-generating merry-go-round with all of its components, the charging station with all of the electronics, the solar panel, which feeds the charging station, 40 LED lanterns, the shipping, and the installation.
All of that for $10,000?
All of that. And the system, we have wonderful sponsors we work with, like Energizer, PlayWorld Systems, Goal Zero. And the equipment that we have through them has such a long lifespan that it really breaks down that cost to about $10 a year per student. So it's a really digestible, low impact cost when you look at it per student.
Is it just merry-go-rounds, or have you thought about expanding the elements of a playground into other ways of producing electricity? When can we get our kids fueling up our TVs here on the stationary bikes that they're riding at home?
That's probably the number one request we get. How can I order one of these to power my fridge or whatever? Our system works wonderfully for an application in a developing country. The power use in the U.S. and other developed places is so high, the merry-go-round wouldn't really put a dent in it. We have toyed around with other things. We have two electricity-generating swing sets that we have installed in island schools in Ghana, and they work remarkably well. We just really like the idea of the merry-go-round because it allows a lot of students to play at once, and it puts all of the components right there in the middle. In fact, each merry-go-round has glass panes so the students can see inside and see all the workings. So it essentially becomes this living science lab that really helps bolster, especially the science, the science education students are getting in these rural places. So I don't know if we'll have a merry-go-round available for installation in the U.S. yet. It may not be the most cost-effective TV power out there.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the executive director of Empower Playgrounds, Chris Cannon. So, Chris, are you looking to expand and multiply these playgrounds in Ghana or go into other countries? Or are you looking to build upon the playgrounds themselves that are already in place?
Good question. We're actually looking at both options. So with the merry-go-rounds, we would like to maintain our focus in Ghana. There are thousands of schools that the government has classified as underprivileged, meaning they don't have electricity, adequate school buildings, enough teachers, books. So we feel like it's really in our organization's best interest to maintain focus in Ghana. However, we've started partnering this year with organizations outside of Ghana who have similar conditions, have an interest in partnering with us to use our technology. So we're hoping to see Empower Playgrounds kind of expand to other countries by using this great network of partnerships we've developed. And then to go along with that, we're starting a program in Ghana this year called Light a Village. And that's in partnership with our solar partner, Goal Zero. And that is a community-wide solar project, which essentially uses large rechargeable batteries that people take to a station, they charge with our solar, and then they take home and use. And And then they pay a few dollars every time they exchange this battery that helps maintain the system. So after the initial investment with our donors installing the system, it's self-sustaining, so it can take care of itself and then allow us to kind of expand rapidly throughout the country.
So how can people help you and your organization, Chris?
We're always looking for people to look at our message, and if they like it, to share it with those around them. We've actually just started this year working with Amazon Smile, so you can do your Christmas shopping online, and then a percentage of that purchase goes towards Empower Playgrounds. So it's a good way to get your necessary Christmas shopping done while doing a little bit of good as well. Or if you just like to donate, there's a donate link on the website. More than welcome to take a look at our stuff.
And the website is empowerplaygrounds.org. Chris Cannon, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to talk with you.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on SeaChange Radio by Councilmember Ash Kara from San Jose's 2nd District. Ash, welcome back to SeaChange Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be back.
Why don't you give us a little overview of an update, if you will, on some of the environmentally focused projects that you've been working on.
Well, I have a number of different hats, and so as a San Jose council member, there are certainly a number of different initiatives. Of course, I think the last time I was here, we had already gotten through a plastic bag ban, and now looking back, it's proven to be a very successful program that many other cities, not just here in California, but around the country, have started to adopt. Right now, we're also pushing forward a polystyrene ban, which is for food takeout, the styrofoam containers, to ban that as well, given the hazards that creates in our recycling efforts and our waste stream. With the other hats I wear, I'm currently chair of the Bay Area Air Quality Management District Board of Directors, which oversees 9 Bay Area counties on air quality. And California, as many know, it leads the nation in terms of some of the greenhouse gas emission goals and other climate change goals that the governor set forth. Our Bay Area Air District is the most progressive air district in the state in terms of also trying to achieve some of those goals. And we just recently passed a climate action plan that actually puts forward not just a resolution in support of those goals, but a plan on how we're going to achieve them from now until 2050. And we're the first air district in the nation to do that. Earlier this year, we also were the first air district in the nation to formally oppose the Keystone Pipeline, and we sent that to the president, the formal resolution in opposition. And so certainly doing a lot of work in terms of the air district. And then finally, some of the other roles I play, I'm vice chair of our local transit authority, VTA, which is focusing on bringing Bay Area Rapid Transit, bringing a subway system into San Jose, as well as operating our light and bus rail system and bus rapid transit. And I'm also on Caltrain board, and that's a regional train system in which we're right now in the process of electrifying, which is the first stage of bringing high-speed rail into the Bay Area eventually and throughout California. I know high-speed rail is something that's being hotly debated and discussed nationwide, and I think it's certainly going to continue to be that way as we try to figure out, as we continue to urbanize, how we figure out how to get people around our states and our regions.
And for our listeners around the country, San Jose is one of the often forgotten cities of the Bay Area, but just to give people an idea of the population that organizations like the the Bay Area Air Quality Management District serves. There's several counties, and the population compares to many states, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it's probably bigger than most states. I mean, the Air District covers a population probably around 6 to 7 million people. San Jose, of course, is the 10th largest city in the nation. We're at about 1 million people, and we dub ourselves the capital of Silicon Valley, so we're certainly in the middle of really this hot economy right now, with technology starting to bounce back up after the recession.
San Jose is a coastal region, just like San Francisco, and as part of the Bay Area. How far in advance does a region like the Bay Area need to look forward in terms of its water pollution with rising sea levels? Are we talking 20, 30 years, or are most of these like near critical type issues that need to be addressed short term?
Well, I'm glad you referred to San Jose as coastal region, because the reality is, even though most people don't recognize it, the Bay actually does come as far as south as San Jose. So sea level rise is something that is certainly something we're very well aware of and we're planning for now, because you can't wait for an issue like that, especially when we see some of the weather events that have been occurring over the last few years, just as recently with the typhoon in the Philippines and tornadoes that are hitting certain parts of the United States later and later in the season. We have to be ready for a sea level rise. And that's not just a San Jose issue. Actually, regionally, we're discussing those issues because it affects certainly San Francisco, Oakland, some of the cities that are closer to the coast, but it also affects San Jose, Palo Alto, Fremont. And so we're putting plans in place now. And in fact, right now, the city is discussing its water pollution control plant master plan, which will discuss how we beef up our levees, what we should do in terms of development, because we have to be cognizant of how much of the land that's in the northern part of San Jose is going to be underwater in 30, 40, or 50 years.
One of the pieces of legislation that probably touches upon a lot of your work, I'm imagining, Ash, is CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, which has been in place for several decades, but it's not without its share of controversy. How do you see legislation like CEQA, not just for California, but as a template for other states?
Yeah, you know, CEQA was passed in 1970, and it's been one of the most successful programs on the planet in terms of setting forward very strong environmental standards.
Briefly, give us a snapshot of what that legislation was in 1970.
Well, the most significant aspect of CEQA is that it requires any developments really to be vetted for its environmental impacts. So even even a corner gas station, to large projects, to a freeway, the environmental impacts had to be disclosed, and mitigation efforts have to be either put in place or at least put on the table for public debate. And so it's been very successful in terms of creating a standard of protecting the environment throughout the state, and has been a national model. Now, that being said, as you mentioned, some of the controversy around it is that certainly CEQA has also been used as a tool for those that are against development or for an opposing business to stop another business from opening up. And it could be two gas stations. So one gas station owner uses CEQA as a weapon to prevent another gas station from opening.
And anybody who's driven around in San Francisco low on gas is familiar with this quandary.
Sure. It could be a development. Maybe a housing development wants to come in, and there's a group of neighbors that are against some affordable housing complex that's going to build 200 units. And so they use CEQA to really hold it up and to keep it either from becoming a development or delay it so much that it makes it a non-economic viability for the developer. And so there have been a number of examples of how CEQA certainly can be used in that way. I think CEQA on the whole is a very good thing to have, and I would certainly like to see CEQA updated, but not reformed in such a manner that takes away the teeth behind it, which is really about making sure the environment is properly taken into account and mitigated before whenever there's a development. And so we certainly can try to find a way to amend it in a way that protects from abuse.
When it's cold and damp in New York City, and all the girls don't look so pretty, and you can't find a job, and you're looking like a slob, go west, realize your dreams, go west, eat pork and beans, go west, wagons home, go west, it's all the rage, go west, get a living wage, go west, wagons home. So climb on board, don't miss this chance. Cowboys do a buckwing dance. It's entertaining, it's never raining. You don't need no more explaining. Go west, realize your dreams. Go west, eat pork and beans. Go west, wagons home. Yeah!
Go west. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to council member Ash Kalra. He represents San Jose's 2nd District. Now, Ash, our listeners are probably fairly familiar with a lot of the bans on plastic bags that have been popping up in many municipalities around the country. San Jose has been at the forefront of that. And you're trying to go a step further now, banning polystyrene containers. Can you give us a little snapshot of how this policy might work?
Well, the law we put into place a couple of years ago outright banned plastic bags, and it charges 10 cents if one wants a paper bag. And what our ban did was far beyond what other major cities had done, because it applied not only to the large big box stores, but every retail outlet. That means the corner convenience store to Macy's and Target.
Restaurants too, because I know there was an exception for the first year.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the exception is prepared foods. And so restaurants were the only exemption from the plastic bag ban. And we've seen that the ban has been very effective. And although there was some opposition initially, we've really gotten a warm response from the community. So now what we've done is we've looked at what we can do in the food industry. And what we felt was most effective was getting rid of polystyrene, getting rid of styrofoam, the takeout containers. They're not recyclable because although polystyrene itself is, once it's soiled, once it's dirty, it's not. And so food obviously is the one area where polystyrene becomes very challenging to recycle as opposed to in packaging. And so we've put in place a ban. It hasn't gone into effect yet, but we have voted it in. So there's a grace period. And what we're doing is we're trying to remove as much of the polystyrene out of our waste stream as possible. And so we hope that this will similarly be well received. We've seen alternative packaging is available now, and it's very competitively priced. And so we're trying to let our business owners know what options they have.
So polystyrene or styrofoam containers, once they have food on them, are not recyclable. So even though they have that little recycling symbol on them, most waste management companies cannot recycle that?
That's right. And so as opposed to plastic where you can rinse it out and kind of throw it in your recycling bin, polystyrene, if it's soiled from food or other waste products, is not.
And most of these are food containers. That's so right. It's kind of absurd to consider these recyclable when they're like little TV dinner sized things. People aren't using polystyrene containers in the food industry for anything but food, right?
That's right. And they are recyclable if you rinse it right away and get the food product off. Now, how many people actually do that?
Or even know about it?
Or even know that you have to do that. That's right. And so it still allows for polystyrene to come into our waste stream through packaging. So if you buy a computer or a TV, but that's not soiled. And so those are clean styrofoam products, which can be recycled. Now, the challenge is actually finding places to take that polystyrene. And so we're working on that in San Jose. Certainly in the meantime, you know, something that I do every year is I do a polystyrene recycling drive every year in January, kind of after the holiday season when people have new products they've bought and have the styrofoam, they don't know what to do with it. And instead of just throwing it into the landfill, we have a chance to actually recycle it. And so we're trying to find opportunities to have recycling drop-off points in our city year-round. But it's challenging because the problem with styrofoam is that it's not necessarily worth it for recyclers to recycle. And the product is very light. And so although you may get a lot in terms of volume, when it's actually compressed, it's not that much recyclable material.
So Ash, you had mentioned your work with Caltrain and the prospect of high-speed rail coming to California. This has been something that has been kicked around for decades. Can you give us an update on that and your stance on it?
High-speed rail is still moving forward. There's definitely been a lot of challenges, and some of those have been legal challenges brought by smaller cities or certain interest groups that want to block it. And oftentimes it's these taxpayer groups and what have you that don't want the money spent. And the reality is that it's not as if it's high-speed rail or nothing. It's high-speed rail, or we build, you know, hundreds of more miles in our freeways. We build X number of miles of runways for our airlines. And so it's not an either-or proposition, really. I believe high-speed rail is something that is necessary for the long-term prospects of the success of our state if we're going to continue to grow, and we know we are. And so if there's a better plan out there, I haven't heard it yet. But high-speed rail certainly needs to be very closely watched and vetted so that we know that the money is spent in an efficient and effective manner. And in the Bay Area, Caltrain has already moved forward with the memorandum of understanding with high-speed rail in terms of electrifying Caltrain, which was a long-term goal of ours all along. We didn't have the few hundred million dollars it takes to do it. And now we are getting money from High Speed Rail Authority in order to help electrify Caltrain, because that electrification is necessary for High Speed Rail to come into the Bay Area.
So since we're talking about high speed rail, there's no silver bullet, obviously, for effective traffic management, but the Bay Bridge was just finally put in. There's a new bridge going from the East Bay of Oakland and Berkeley to San Francisco. But there's been many studies that show just expanding lanes in highways doesn't really solve the problem. What are some of the solutions that you and your colleagues have been finding to be the most effective?
We have to get people out of cars, but it's too simplistic to simply say that. The reality is, if you don't create a network that is practical of transit options, people are going to still drive. And we're still working on that in the Bay Area, especially outside of the urbanized areas like San Francisco, where we're very spread out in San Jose. And this is similar, I think, probably nationwide, where you have these suburban communities that have been built some distance away from urban cores. How do you get people in those suburban communities, these communities that were built on the fact that everyone had a car in their garage? How do you get them out of their cars? And that's been the biggest challenge. And we're working on it in a number of ways. And it's really about being multimodal. And that means having buses, light rail, bike share, Caltrain, BART, eventually high-speed rail, you know, ferry system, you name it. Giving every opportunity for someone to be able to connect from any part of the Bay Area to the other part that they are trying to arrive at. It's very challenging to do, and it's not going to happen overnight, but we are seeing some success in getting people out of their cars. We're seeing more and more people ride transit, but it's imperative that the elected officials that are in place continue to connect the dots, and we can't just tell people, oh, get out of your cars. We have to make it practical for them.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show, Ash. Councilmember Ash Kara, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by King Sunny Ade, Phil Lesh and Friends, and Garant Watkins. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.